Hello, my name is Cindy Winslow. I am the director of Yowie Museum and Cultural Center, and today I'm going to be presenting on the project that we have. It's to preserve our copy of the Durant Roll. Just to give you a little brief overview of the museum, this is the front of it, and we're the Museum for the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indian, opened in May of 2009. A Yowing in Anishinaabe Mohan, which is our language, means who we are. And the exhibits showcase the history and culture of the Odawa, the Ojibwe, and the Potawatomi people of our sovereign nation. We're located in Peshawetown, Michigan, which is the northwest lower peninsula of Michigan. It's also called the Pinky, the little right there. So our project, the overreaching goal of the project, was to increase the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians' capacity to preserve and share our tribal culture and history. So the objective is to preserve the Grand Traverse Band, or GTB, silverback copy of the Durant Roll, which was used in our federal recognition process and now is considered a community heirloom. You can see that... right now, I just have it in a acid-free box with acid-free paper wrapped around it. It's extremely fragile. Like, if you touch it, the silver starts coming off the back. But it's kind of, I've never seen silverback copies before, so it's kind of interesting. And you can kind of see some of the writing and stuff that's on it. Our first activity was to contact Northeast Document Conservation Center and the Northern States Conservation Center to register for trainings. And I have a list of the trainings that we are planning on doing. You know, the basic preservation of analog and digital collections, which they now call Preservation 101. It starts in May of 2016. The care handling of paper-based collections. It's a one-day webinar. It's held on March 8th. On 2016, the care of paper artifacts, which is through the Northern States Conservation Center, and those are online training classes. And they do not have a date set up, but they do say that they to check back for fiscal year 2016. Intros to collection preservation is also a Northern States Conservation Center class, and it's going to be held from April 6th to May 1st. All these classes are online, so we didn't need any additional travel. So our activities are the project staff will participate in the four online classes. Then after the learning the proper way of handling, we will buy the necessary preservation materials, and then we will utilize that knowledge to complete and preserve the silverback copies of the Durant Roll. And then we will also submit information in our newsletter to our members about what we're doing and how we did the project. Some of the challenges that we had for this project was we had to secure match funds from our tribal council to be used to hire the project staff. We had actually overexpended our allotted budget in for the museum for matches. So we had to ask for more money. We also have had a lack of individuals applying for the position. We had it on our HR website for several months and no one applied at all. And the one individual we did have hired did not stay in the position. They left. So our successes was that we did receive the funds from Tribal Council, and we also received an extension on the grant for the following year. I also put in more pictures of the Durant Roll. I mean, you can see on the edges right there how delicate and I want to say crispy. It's almost like they're crispy. And then some of the information, it almost looks like a negative on the paper itself. So that concludes our project, and with Sheila, she's in the back, she's my supervisor, and then I'm the museum director. Just some information about if you want to come visit the museum. We're open Saturday or Wednesday through Saturday from 10 until 4. So thank you.
Good morning. My name is Janet Smoke again, and I am the director of the Suquamish Museum on Port Madison Indian Reservation. And that is located just directly across the sound from Seattle, Washington. And our IMLS grant is also fairly narrow in scope, but it is allowing us to accomplish something that is large in aspect for our program. The Suquamish Museum program is a little over 30 years old now. And it was begun in the late 1870s as an oral history project and then opened in 1983 as a museum in what was essentially converted attic space in the tribal center, the government center. And that impetus to form a museum was really rested in the elders of that generation who were recognizing that if they did not at that moment in time try to capture as much of the historic and cultural knowledge as possible from a generation that was at least connected as children or grandchildren from a time when the people still lived in the traditional way, that a lot of that knowledge would be lost in its entirety. And the value of those oral history collections and the photographs that were collected then continue to be the strongest part of our program. They are used in every exhibit we do. They are referenced in public programs. They have become essentially the common memory that everything is built upon now. But part of our patrimony, part of what the museum holds and cares for, is also archaeological collections. Now, we are blessed in the fact that the Suquamish tribe lives on ancestral ground. They have been there always. And so whenever anyone goes to build something and they have to go through the 106 processes, the material that comes out of the ground in our area is Suquamish material. In Washington State, that material would go to the Burke Museum, which is the state museum. We are fortunate in Suquamish that the museum staff in Suquamish and the staff at the Burke Museum, since the very beginning of our program, came together and were really good partners. Our staff learned a lot from them. Their staff learned a lot from the Suquamish. And in the foundation of that essentially meant that when it was time to bring archaeological collections home, that relationship then allowed to make it not only possible, but a joyful occasion. And not last year, but the fall of the year before, they brought home the Old Man House archaeological collection from the Burke Museum to Suquamish. That collection is from the ancestral site in the Suquamish village. The Old Man House was the longhouse that was Chief Seattle's, his father Shwebe before him. And it had been housed at the Burke Museum by that point for over 50 years. The reason we built a brand new 12,000 square foot facility in downtown, or in downtown, it's, you know, one crossroads, in Suquamish Village was to bring that collection home. And with that collection there, and also processed up to the state-of-the-art collection standards of a state museum, it then became a template that allowed us to build into more of what we were doing in-house. There's another collection that the museum owns because it was transferred from the Navy straight to the museum called the Minette Village Site, which geographically is located in Bremerton, Washington, not very far from Suquamish. That village site was about the same age, or the archaeological material is comparable to that which came from Old Man House site. And this grant is written to process that archaeological collection in the same manner as the material returned from the Burke Museum. And it is about 30-odd boxes worth of material. So, and it is primarily archaeological samples. So paper bag after paper bag of shell samples. And we have been able to put it in more stable housing because essentially these boxes, it was very difficult even to pick up the box and move it from here to there for fear that you were disturbing what was inside. So it has allowed us to repackage and stabilize that. It's also allowing us to get it online in a smaller unit by unit description. We're taking photographs of the material for our Past Perfect program. We're converting to Past Perfect 5. And in that way, we hope as time goes on, the Manette site, the Old Man House site, we're negotiating currently for a couple of other collections to come home from various other repositories. And even with our museum, even if we don't end up as an owner of the material, we will become a repository. So rather than send to the Burke as a repository, they can send Suquamish material to Suquamish and they can have a repository there so that Suquamish people can have access to their own materials. I think the most difficult part of the process thus far really has been the challenges that we all face in the sense that there's never enough staffing or funding to really do all that you wish to do. We have a part-time curator. She's also a gooey duck diver, which is the traditional way of making a living there if you're a fisherman, one of the traditional ways. And as a gooey duck diver, she makes 10 times and more in a day what she would make in a month at the Suquamish Museum. So the curatorial work that she does, that she has learned how to do, is her passion. She does it because she's Suquamish. So that there is a great challenge in only having that part-time curator. And there has been a fair amount of administrative challenge in trying to migrating our Past Perfect 4 database material to the Past Perfect 5 database. Not because it's difficult to do, because Past Perfect is very easy to work with, but because in the transfer, we're also modernizing the IT system that supports it. So, for instance, it used to be on a standalone hard drive. Now it's going onto a network. There's great debate suddenly about whether or not we trust our collections out there on the cloud. So there's been a lot of conversation about exactly technologically how we want to do this, how it's safe, and I think we're almost there. The digitization project has been simple. We have past IMLS grants that have helped us with that in the past, so that's a known activity and we're doing well there. The other issue too was establishing a nomenclature protocols for the archaeological collections because there really wasn't one before. We are of course using our friends at the Burke as a template, but it wasn't something that we should simply take all of their language and then use it. There was a great deal of review and debate what was appropriate. And by and large, very little of what they have used as a template has changed, but some things have. And then so we've had to create that in the Past Perfect system. And then also just for, you know, those who come after us, also try to look at how we validate and note why we use this term versus that term or how we chose this path. Just in that case, knowing full well in 20 years they may change their minds, we want them to at least see our reasoning, not just our output, our end product. And just sort of to close is with this grant, it was always meant to be for a future project. We want to digitize, we want to bring these collections up onto a database that will eventually be shared on the web, primarily so that we can attract research projects, students, professionals, because there, with all of this material that we have, there's still not a lot written or known about aspects of Suquamish Village life and culture. And we have a very strong biology fisheries department. Caring for the health of the Puget Sound is a prime priority. However, everyone recognizes that the way to fix the present is to reinstitute the best practices from the past, because for eons that sound was well taken care of by indigenous people. And so there's great need to look back in that record, using the archaeological record, as modern scientific evidence to help say, this is the resource and how it was used. This is how it was protected. So it's also about being able to generate those science projects. Currently out of Canada, BC, there is a project, for instance, going on the use of herring and all of the different species of, herring, thought I said heron there for a second, herring, in the sense that it was a staple of the diet. Most people associate salmon as a staple. It was very important, but herring was the sort of the potatoes. You know, they were the, it was the most common used fish. So there's already some ongoing, but we need to be able to meet it with material. And then, of course, the true need, the holy grail, so to speak, is attracting young people, students. We work a lot with our Chief Kitsap Academy students. Suquamish is the first tribal school district in the nation. And it was just established this past year. And we're really trying to focus on creating internship programs that interest students in historic preservation, in archaeology, and in museum studies. Because so much of what we do at the museum is only going to move forward is if we can find that next generation. Even Lydia Saiga, who is our curator, her father, Charlie, was the curator that established this collection. So in a sense, it's a family job. Her sister Robin is the president of our museum board of trustees. So if I can't find another Saigo kid, I need to find another family who can step in and take on that ownership of the museum and its collections so that we have that next generation. So at heart, all of these grants are about finding that next generation. And that's definitely what this one is about too. But thank you.
Hey, aloha, I'm K.L. George. I'm with the Hula Preservation Society, and before I share our project, I'll give you a little background on who we are. We were founded in 2000 by Auntie Nona Beamer. She's pictured there in the middle with the red jacket and black sleedle alongside her adopted daughter, Maile Lu. And it grew out of a concern that there was a generation rapidly passing on that held vast amounts of undocumented cultural knowledge, particularly pertaining to hula. And so many of these elders are prominent musical and hula families of the islands, or were trained by some of the last court dancers of the Hawaiian kingdom. HPS's core work is in documenting these elders using video oral histories, and we recently established a repository that houses thousands of photographs, papers, manuscripts, and artifacts that they have gifted us over the years. And HPS is unique in the sense that we're the only ones doing this type of work currently. And so our project was Nana Kupuna e Alakaia Kako. It was a five-part cultural series that we held on four islands. And this project initially grew out of observed need for a greater understanding of community histories and the legacies that originate in those communities. And again, HPS is in a unique position to share this type of culture information as we embrace all hula teachings and lineages. Typically in Hawaii, hula lines hold specific lineages, including styles and dance traditions. And so HPS doesn't just focus on one specific lineage. There's a diversity of hula across all the islands, and we've been fortunate to work with elders from all the different islands. That has given us a wide exposure to hula knowledge, and in turn, we've been able to share that information so people get a chance to hear from an older generation as we know, is responsible for most of the reasons why particular community practices live on. So through this project, we are able to connect people with their own histories that they otherwise would not have been aware of. And they walk away knowing more about their home, their families, and feeling empowered to perpetuate and preserve culture and learning. With a variety of information that we have collected and the friendships we've maintained over the years, we tailored each of these cultural presentations to the island that we were presenting on. to enhance that community's cultural understanding. So the first place we traveled to was Maui. And at this presentation, we partnered with the Maui Arts and Cultural Center. And we focused on families and individuals of Maui Island known to still reside there and be very prominent in the community. We used archival video clips, oral history interview clips, still photographs, and live talk story from family members and students of Maui Hula Masters. We then returned to our home island, Oahu, where we partnered with the International Waikiki Hula Conference. And at this presentation, we kind of highlighted families and individuals from throughout the islands, as we not only had people from Hawaii there, but Hawaiians and hula enthusiasts from abroad. So again, we used archival video clips, oral history interview clips, and we even had a guest speaker, Auntie Bev Muraoka from Kauai, who really gave context to many of the hula and musical talents that we highlighted that day. We then traveled to Hawaii Island, where we partnered with the Imiloa Astronomy Center as part of the Merry Monarch Hula Festival, and it is the largest hula festival in the world. I'm sorry, I should have said hula is Hawaiian dance, if you're not familiar with what hula is. I just realized that. But we were able to shed light on two amazing women while we were there. The first was Master Iolani Luahine, and she was chosen as a focus as she was the foremost exponent on hula in the 20th century. She was born on Hawaii Island, and this year marked the 100th anniversary of her birth. We then also focused on our founder, Auntie Nona, as she was raised on Hawaii Island. She, her family and her hula lineage reside very heavily there. And she is a very beloved elder of her generation, as she inspired many modern day academics and community leaders and hula masters of today. We then presented at the Brigham Young University Hawaii campus in May of this year, and we partnered with the university's archive for this presentation. And we really tailored this presentation for students and instructors of the university, particularly in the Hawaiian Studies, Polynesian Studies, Hawaiian Language and Music programs. And the emphasis of the presentation was placed on hula families and elders from the area where the university is located. Many of these individuals still reside in the community, are very prominent in community matters, and have even taught at the university over the years. And so the presentation gave students and faculty a real sense of the historic importance and resources that the surrounding community holds for them. And last but not least, we traveled to Molokai in June, and this was at the invitation of the Molokai hula community in conjunction with their hula festival, Kahula Piko. And Molokai is a very tight-knit rural community, and they're often overlooked. And so it was a real great opportunity to go there and talk with people and to provide them with a chance for them to not only hear from their elders, but to connect to cultural greats that are often spoken about by the older generation, but not experienced by the younger. So I'm just gonna show you a quick highlight video that will give you a sense of how our programs were on the outer islands. And it's just a couple minutes.
I started with Auntie Ia when I was 17. In 2 months, I will be 85. So it's been a while. It's been a while. But the hula, I think, has kept me in good health and in good mind. And the spirit is in. Check.
three of my uncles were his haumana, so I used to, when they went in for training, as soon as the pahu beat, they all left whatever they were doing and they would run to the halau, which was my grandmother's home was the halau. They used it as a halau. It was just a lauhala shack with ili-ili pebbles for the flooring they didn't have. And you can imagine them training to dance the hula on ili-ili. But they trained for 1 hour, and I used to go along and walk and keep timing to the beat whenever then, and did some of the steps.
So we had a lot of fun. But that's it. Thank you so much, and thank you to IMLS.
Good morning, everybody. We're from Gila River Indian Community. My name is Monica King. I'm the education curator, and I have with me my colleague and my project team member. There are three of us in the education department, and we both work for the Huhukam Heritage Center. The Gila River Indian Community, our enrollment is roughly around 21,000, 22,000. We are in central Phoenix, central southern Phoenix area of Arizona, Phoenix, Arizona area, and we have roughly 350,000 acres of land stretching from what you see is Phoenix just above here. Our land goes from a sort of northwest to southeast direction, which was, and right through it is the Gila River. There is no more Gila River. They had dammed it up in the 1800s and end of the 1800s and 1930s. So And what's detrimental to us is that there is no water. We need, and our project is actually about the preservation of our basket weaving. And without the loss of that habitat, those communities, those areas, that we're struggling in terms of the continuation of our weaving. Luis and I both work at the Huhukam Heritage Center. We opened in 2004. We're out in the desert, just south of Phoenix, in what's called a little community called Chandler area. We have a museum, which we do have an administration. We have an archives library area, very small, very tiny classrooms. And we have in the central portion, right in the middle, you'll see that is our collections area, mostly archaeological collection. And to the left, in this picture here, this larger facility is our museum and museum area. And we're open pretty much only a few days a week. We are a staff of 13 right now, and we hope to grow. The scope of our work we applied for this grant is to basically, one, we're losing our tradition, this very important tradition. We have several collections at the Heritage Center, roughly about maybe about 400 baskets. But right now we're looking, the main scope of the focus is to identify who in the community is weaving. Or we want to do oral histories with these individuals. We want to identify who these family members are. From right now, we only have about, what I can count is probably 10 who are practicing. We did have a weaving forum, and we're looking maybe about 40 individuals who are still know about the weaving practice, but again, only 10 individuals, and one who definitely is very has been very successful. Two, we're looking to associate those weavers with our collection. And three, any of the materials that we do collect or will be going into our the Heritage Center archives, but as and we'll also be using it in the future for education as well as research for community members to use. The current state of weaving at Heal River. Again, we only have a handful of weavers that we are aware of. So the first thing to do is gather together, network, find out who in the community is weaving. We're finding out that there's only probably a handful of elders in terms of about six that we are aware of who really know the practice of weaving, how to harvest the materials, and now we're trying to establish those relationships with the groups, with these individuals. We have several different collections out at the Heritage Center, largely the Brazil Basket Collection, a large collection of 83 baskets. We have what we currently have, and I think we collected about 5 years ago, the Blackwater Store Collection. It was about another 84, 85 baskets. And that was from an individual in the community who sold in a trading post, sold to the community members over the last 50 years. And he had amassed this wonderful collection of baskets himself. And he moved on, and the baskets came back to the Heritage Center, or were sold back to the community. And so we have those in our collection. We have two other smaller collections, which are about, I'd say, another 70 to 80 baskets in these two collections also. So the Heritage Center collections are associate documenting identifying weavers. Project background. This is one of our historic weavers, Nellie Preston, and that was a photograph taken from Mr. Brazil in roughly around the 1930s. Myself, there are three of us working on this project, Mr. Luis Barragan and another tribal member, Mr. Robert Johnson, who's a museum aide. We are also working with several of our tribal departments who are assisting us, and one in particular is the training. The helping of our audiovisual equipment is a group called EditBox, which is under our tribal education department. We are also working, they're assisting us too, is the tribal education department also, who are giving us access to some of their footage that we're collecting. GRIC weavers, we're going into the community, working with all the elders, and roughly our population again is roughly, of this group, the weavers, we're looking maybe 40 to 60 that we're aware of. Hill River Indian Community families of historic weavers. We're also finding out that we have about, I'd say, how many families?
10,
maybe 15 family members who are directly associated with our historic collection. And we're trying to schedule those meetings with these family members right now. Our project was delayed. We did have some problems, and largely they had to do with procurement and purchasing the tools that we needed. In August, we met with how many families? I think we connected with maybe about 20, 30 individuals from the weaving community who helped us in terms of being our consultants. In community, we had community outreach. We went to several, we have seven districts in our community. And to each one of those districts, we had presentations with those groups. We also hosted a basket weaving forum in March, which was overwhelming with maybe 49 participants coming, and to discuss pretty much what is the status of our community in terms of basket weaving. Where are we going with it? How do we revive it? Is it important? And what are the steps in terms of preserving our basket weaving? So oral history interviews, to date, we've only been out on how many occasions? I'd say three occasions to work with families, but we're on target to do at least 15 by the end of this year as part of our documentation. Video documentation. This is Luis. He is our